Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Continuing to read from presidential historian Michael Betschloss's Presidents of War and his essay on President Harry S. Truman and the Korean War. On Wednesday afternoon, July 5, 1950, in a graveyard near the South Korean capital of Seoul, under a pounding rain, Private Kenneth Shadrick, 18, of Skinfork, West Virginia, ducked into a foxhole. It was 11 days after the People's Army of North Korea had invaded the South. Under a UN Security Council resolution that he had engineered, President Harry Truman had rushed in U.S. armed forces from Japan, which had been occupied by Americans since World War II, and where General Douglas MacArthur was still the military governor. The quiet, blonde, blue-eyed, child-faced Shadrick was a coal miner's son, the third of 10 children. His father, Theodore, later recalled that Kenny never caused us a mite of worry. All that boy liked was to sit hunched up there with a book and a piece of cold bread. An A student, the son favored books about cowboys, as well as the lurid pulp science fiction magazine Fantastic Novels. Tightly wound, he played high school football until the day someone stole his uniform from his locker, and he told his mother Lucille, "I'll never go another day of school." Eager to see some of the world, Kenny obtained written permission from his parents to join the Army. Leaving his Appalachian Hollow, he went through basic training at Fort Knox, Kentucky, and shipped out to Japan. At first, he was exhilarated by the novelties, but by the spring of 1950, he was writing Lucille, "Mom, this place is getting me down." This Wednesday was the first day of American ground engagement with the North Koreans. 22 miles south of Seoul, Kenny Shadrick and others on his bazooka team fired at advancing enemy tanks. From his mud hole, he shouted, "One, two, three," so that an army photographer could capture the flame from one of his buddy's rocket launcher. Raising his head above ground level to see whether they had made a direct hit, Shadrick was struck by machine gun fire. Dropping forward, he cried, "Oh, my arm." As a lieutenant grabbed his wrist to feel his pulse, Kenny died of a wound near his heart. "They've got Shadrick right in the chest," a fellow soldier exclaimed. "He's dead, I guess." Kenny Shadrick's remains were taken to a nearby hut where an Army medic observed, "What a place to die." Marguerite Higgins of the New York Herald Tribune newspaper, who had covered the Allied conquest of Berlin during World War II, thought the young man's lifeless face looked surprised. She much later wrote, "The prospect of death had probably seemed as unreal to Private Shadrick as the entire war still seemed to me." The young man was awarded a posthumous Purple Heart. Kenny's family learned the news over breakfast from a neighbor who had heard it from the radio. His father told a reporter that all he knew about Korea was that it was where his son had been killed. Asked about Kenny's mission, Theodore Shadrick could only reply that he was fighting against some kind of government. Fury and shock over Kenny's sudden death made his brother Leroy, 25, wish to fight in Korea himself. At 101 pounds, Leroy was too light to enlist, so he gorged himself for a week to become a soldier. Obsessed with what the North Koreans did to my brother, Leroy vowed to kill 20 of the enemy for every year he spent on Earth. Leroy Shadrick later recalled that once he got to Korea, his mind blanked out, and he heard his dead little brother's voice. Discharged by the Army, he was treated in more than one mental institution and went to prison for income tax fraud. After his release in 1956, Leroy tried to hold up a bank in North Carolina, seeking $5,000 to pay for travel to Independence, Missouri, so he could assassinate former President Truman, whom he held directly responsible for his brother's death. Leroy had planned to murder Truman on the anniversary of Kenny's demise. The day, he later explained, when all of his own troubles began. In those days, retired presidents did not enjoy Secret Service protection. They had none until after John Kennedy's assassination. But this did not bother Harry Truman. Before leaving the presidency in 1953, Harry Truman had vowed, "If any nut tries to shoot me, I'll take the pistol away from him, ram it down his throat, and pull the trigger." Harry Truman had first been told of the North Korean assault on Saturday night, June 24, 1950, at the family's white clapboard Victorian house in Independence, Missouri. Planning a tranquil weekend with his wife Bess and their daughter Margaret, who had gone home for their annual summer respite, he had written a friend, the diplomat Stanley Woodward, that he expected to order a new roof on the farmhouse and tell some politicians to go to hell. A grand visit, I hope. It was 89 degrees that Saturday when the black car pulled up at the Truman home from the Kansas City airport, and the grinning president stepped out swinging a cane. Someone in the crowd shouted, referring to the fraternal order, "Harry, we missed you at the meeting of the Eagles." Truman explained that a president just can't be everywhere he'd like to go. After dinner, the family sat on the screened-in porch with Truman's haughty mother-in-law, Madge Wallace, who had always disdained Harry and still did. By 9:30 that night, Harry retreated to his small, high-ceilinged library on the side of the house. Secretary of State Dean Acheson called to say, "Mr. President, I have very serious news. The North Koreans have invaded South Korea." Margaret Truman later wrote that as soon as her father heard the report, he feared this was the opening round in World War III. Loath to scare Americans and much of the world with a sudden flight back to Washington, D.C., Truman opted to spend the night in Independence, Missouri, waiting to obtain intelligence on the magnitude of the invasion. Sunday morning journals were alive with the news. "South Korea invaded by Reds," said the Arizona Republic newspaper. A White House press aide claimed that the president was concerned but not alarmed about Korea. Feigning calm, Truman made a pre-announced visit to his younger brother Vivian's farm at Grandview, Missouri, where Truman viewed a new horse and an electric milking contraption. Back to his own house by noon, he took another call from Secretary of State Acheson, who reported that the North Korean action was clearly no rogue caprice, but a full-scale offensive. By Truman's later recollection, he replied, "Dean, we've got to stop the sons of a bitches no matter what." He hurried upstairs to his bedroom where he packed his bags and donned a double-breasted suit and bow tie. He departed his hometown so abruptly that two aides were left behind. At the airport, when he climbed the stairs to his silvery presidential DC-6 airplane, the Independence, his wife and daughter stayed behind on the tarmac, looking distraught. His daughter recorded in her diary that everything is extremely tense because Communist Korea is marching in on Southern Korea, and we are going to fight. While flying to Washington, Truman looked out the window and recalled how Hitler had been allowed to occupy the Rhineland and Japan march into Manchuria unchallenged in the 1930s. He mused that the strong had attacked the weak, and that each time that the democracies failed to act, it had encouraged the aggressors to keep going ahead. Truman also remembered how the League of Nations in 1936 had failed to stop Mussolini from seizing Ethiopia. He believed that if the free world did not resist the North Koreans now, affirming the principles of the United Nations, then no small nation would have the courage to resist threats and aggressions by stronger communist neighbors, ushering a Third World War. Early in the evening, his airplane, the Independence, landed at the capital's national airport. As Truman stepped out of the plane, spectators applauded. Greeted by Secretary of State Acheson and Secretary of Defense Lewis Johnson, the president, clutching his Panama hat, paused for photographers and then told him, "That's all. We've got a job to do." Riding in his car with the other two men and Undersecretary of State James Webb across the Potomac and into Washington, Truman invade against the North Koreans. By God, I'm going to let them have it. From the jump seat, Johnson swiveled around and vigorously shook the president's hand. Born in 1884 to struggling Missouri farmers, Truman never forgot the hardships of his own family, slaveholders on both sides, in the Civil War. As a child, he was told by his mother Martha of how early in the conflict, Union soldiers had forced her own mother, Louisa Young, to make them biscuits and then slaughtered the family's livestock, set the barns aflame, and stole everything loose that they could carry. The Northern marauders nearly hanged Martha's brother Harrison while trying to force him to admit that their father, Solomon Young, was a Confederate soldier, asking where he was hiding. Martha Truman so detested the Union victors that she felt Abraham Lincoln deserved assassination. Before she visited the White House, she told her son Vivian, "You tell Harry, if he tries to put me in Lincoln's bed, I'll sleep on the floor." Hearing his relatives speak of the Civil War quickened young Harry's interest in history. Nearsighted, he was kept by his hardscrabble parents out of contact sports because if he broke his eyeglasses, they could not easily afford a replacement. Truman would later say that as a result, he read every book in the Independence Public Library. His favorite, however, was a set of gilt-edged volumes published in 1895 that Martha Truman had bought from a traveling salesman called Great Men and Famous Women, on the presumption that females could never be great, only famous, which offered brief profiles by sundry authors of over 200 eminent figures, from Nebuchadnezzar to Sarah Bernhardt. Truman particularly admired the generals, Hannibal, Andrew Jackson, and Martha Truman's hero, Robert E. Lee. For him, reading history was not romantic adventure, but solid instruction and wise teaching, which I somehow felt I wanted and needed. From his later vantage point of the White House, Truman believed that if a president knew the history of his predecessors, it would be easier for him to go through a similar experience, and that it was ignorance that causes most mistakes. He insisted that not all readers become leaders, but all leaders must be readers, and that the only thing new in the world is the history you don't know. As was true of Woodrow Wilson, Truman's reading helped him to form very specific views of earlier wartime presidents. He dismissed James Madison as a commander-in-chief who found it difficult to make decisions, a weak sister. I don't think we want to blame his intellectualism for the fact that he wasn't a very good president. It was just that when it came time for him to act like an executive, he was like a great many of other people. They have difficulty doing it. Truman deemed the War of 1812 a disaster for us from the start. Truman admired James Polk's strenuous, undaunted use of presidential power through the Mexican War, including his quarrels with Congress. With Polk in mind, Truman felt that every strong president always has trouble with the Congress, whether there's a war on or not. But whenever the president knows what he's doing and knows it's right, he can always convince the Congress and tell them what the situation is and why certain things have to be done. You never have any trouble with them after that, said Truman. Truman honored Lincoln because he saved the Union, and that's the important thing. He identified with Lincoln's modest origins and admired how he pushed the Constitution to its limits to wage the Civil War, knowing both its intentions and the powers that aren't put down in writing and were there to be used by a president in emergencies. Truman said that Lincoln aimed to stretch the Constitution, but never actually cracked it. After high school, too poor to afford college, Harry Truman thirsted, so he later said, for appointment to West Point, but was disqualified by his myopia. In 1905, he enlisted in the National Guard. They needed recruits, and while working his family farm, stayed in for 6 years. In June 1917, 2 months after President Woodrow Wilson took the nation into the Great War, Truman re-entered the National Guard, later writing that, as a true patriot, he was stirred heart and soul by Wilson's wartime messages. He later described Wilson's 14 points as one of the greatest and most eloquent documents in the history of the country. His adulation of Wilson may have seemed to clash with his antipathy towards Ivy League intellectuals, but underneath Truman's brisk, practical facade was an idealistic core that responded to Wilson's romantic vision of a world grounded on international law. From high school, Harry had in his own hand copied and recopied rhyming couplets from Locksley's Hall, Tennyson's long dramatic monologue of 1835, and kept the scraps of paper in his wallet for most of his life, including the following: "Till the war drum throbbed no longer and the battle flags were furled in the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World. There the common sense of most shall hold a fretful realm in awe, and the kindly earth shall slumber, lapped in universal law." Fighting in France meant leaving his beloved Bess Wallace back in Independence, Missouri. As Truman wrote in 1931, by heeding Woodrow Wilson's call, "I felt that I was a Galahad after the Grail, and I'll never forget how my love cried on my shoulder when I told her I was going. That was worth a lifetime on this earth." Before his training at Camp Doniphan in Oklahoma, he declined to marry Bess, writing her, "I don't think it would be right for me to ask you to tie yourself to a prospective cripple. Truman pledged to be just as loyal to you as if you were my wife." He would not extract any promises from her not to go out with any other guy, "but I'll be as jealous as a mischief, although not begrudging you the good time." Referring to the German Kaiser, he wrote Bess, "I do not want to be in on the death of this scourge of God. Just think of what he'll do to our great country and our beautiful women, if he only could." In March 1918, Truman and his comrades boarded the USS George Washington, the same ship that later took Woodrow Wilson to France. "There, we were watching New York's skyline diminish," Truman later recalled, "and wondering if we would be heroes or corpses." That July, serving with the 129th Field Artillery, he took command of Battery D, the first serious leadership assignment of his life. "Captain Harry," wrote Bess, "that before the enemy in Alsace, France, amid the great hubbub and excitement, he was struck by a real creepy feeling. He confessed to her the fear beneath his bravado, stating, 'The men think I'm not much afraid of shells, but they don't know I was too scared to run, and that is pretty scared.'" Truman's battery suffered only a single fatality. After the armistice that November in 1918, he noted that the front had grown so quiet it made your head ache. With the war done, he complained to a cousin that Woodrow Wilson's arrival in France to shape the peace had postponed his own return to Missouri. Thus, he was very anxious that Woody cease his gallivanting around the world. After the Great War, Truman married Bess and opened a haberdashery store in Kansas City with his Battery D chum, Eddie Jacobson, which in time collapsed. Elected county judge in 1922 and to the U.S. Senate in 1934 as a Roosevelt man, Truman felt deeply wounded and resentful when, during the 1940 campaign, President Roosevelt encouraged Truman's primary opponent, Governor Lloyd Stark. Knowing his American history, Truman remembered how the Committee on the Conduct of the War had browbeaten Lincoln. In early 1941, Truman won the Senate's consent to establish a far more modest version of the panel, with himself as chairman, to monitor Roosevelt's rearmament program for the war. Drawn to the subject by his indignation when small businesses were squeezed out of the action, the Missouri senator was not unaware that his new role would establish him as a major Washington figure. Unlike Lincoln's scourges, Chandler and Wade, Truman made it clear that he had no interest in advising the president on which generals to promote, noting that his committee does not go on fishing expeditions. Nevertheless, President Roosevelt tried to clip the new panel's wings by deploying Senate allies to keep its funding small. The magnificent sum of $15,000 carped Truman. After Pearl Harbor, Truman tried to join the Army at age 57, but was told by General Marshall, "We don't need old stiffs like you. This will be a young man's war." Senator Truman sent a message to Roosevelt asking how his committee could help. When the president did not respond, Truman complained to his wife, "Roosevelt's so damn afraid that he won't have all the power and glory that he won't let his friends help as it should be done." Throughout the war, Truman managed to scrutinize national defense with sufficient aplomb as to make him a serious option in 1944 when Roosevelt looked for a new vice president to replace Henry Wallace. Then, in April 1945, as Truman exclaimed, "The moon, the stars, and all the planets fell upon him." After the Allies defeated Japan, which had occupied Korea, the United States and Soviet Union divided the Korean Peninsula at the 38th parallel after World War II. This dividing line, so far north, was proposed by a young State Department official, Dean Rusk of Georgia, who had been a colonel in the war's China-Burma-India theater. Rusk was eager to include the Korean capital of Seoul in the region for which U.S. forces would be responsible, even though it would be more difficult to defend. By 1948, the Soviet and American zones had evolved into national entities of their own, with the Communist North under Kim Il-sung and the South Republics of Korea under President Syngman Rhee. U.S. and Soviet troops withdrew from the Korean Peninsula. The authoritarian Kim Il-sung was eager to invade the South, but when he went to Moscow in March 1949 to press his case, Stalin, recoiling from the danger of a shooting war with the United States, would not grant his consent. But the Soviet leader took notice when President Truman declined to employ the U.S. military in an effort to keep China from falling to Mao Zedong's communists. Joseph Stalin was also told by some Soviet intelligence officials that Truman did not consider it crucial enough to defend South Korea by military force. Against this backdrop, in January 1950, Truman's Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, appeared before the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Acheson, who had given the United States that shove towards war against Japan in 1941, without sanction from President Roosevelt, now accidentally signaled Kim Il-sung of North Korea that America might not respond with military action should his armies invade South Korea. In his speech, Secretary Acheson described the American defense perimeter in East Asia, but it did not include Taiwan or South Korea, which he said would be protected by the United Nations. The Cold War scholar John Lewis Gaddis has written that Secretary Acheson's speech significantly reshaped Joseph Stalin's thinking on the risks of war with the United States in East Asia. After Secretary Acheson's address, Kim Il-sung secretly told Moscow that it was time to liberate South Korea. General Terentiy Shchaikov, the Soviet envoy to North Korea, wrote the Kremlin that Kim would not launch an attack on his own because he is a communist, a disciplined person, and for him, the order of Comrade Stalin is law, but reported that Kim believed that if he acted, South Korea would have little hope of American assistance. That April, during another visit to Moscow, Kim Il-sung repeatedly assured Joseph Stalin that the Americans would never participate in the war, and that if such a conflict began with North Korea, it would last only a few days because South Korea would welcome his army as liberators. Stalin warned Kim not to expect great assistance from the Kremlin, which had more important challenges to meet. If you should get kicked in the teeth, I shall not lift a finger. You have to ask Mao Zedong for all the help. The result, as Gaddis later wrote, was the first overt military assault across an internationally recognized boundary since the end of World War II. On Sunday evening, June 25, 1950, Truman arrived at Blair House, the presidential guest quarters across Pennsylvania Avenue from the White House, where the first family was residing during the three-year reconstruction of the crumbling executive mansion. First, he went upstairs to telephone his wife, Bess, that he had landed safely. Walking down the staircase, he vowed almost to himself, "We cannot let the UN down. We cannot let the UN down." Then he joined a dozen guests for cocktails in the garden, including his secretaries of state and defense, his chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Omar Bradley, and other military and diplomatic officials. Dining at 7:45 that evening, with the French doors flung open to admit the soft evening breeze, the president later wrote his wife, Bess, that the downstairs rooms were very hot. Truman did not get down to business until the meal, fried chicken, asparagus, biscuits, shoestring potatoes, and vanilla ice cream with chocolate topping was over, and the servers were out of sight. Reading from Michael Beschloss's essay on Harry Truman and the Korean War will continue. This is Wallace Klinghast, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.